Now for another interview by Red Eye Co-op Radio on Bolivia's new government.
Bolivia's poor and indigenous majority has fought battle after battle against a slew of neoliberal economic policies. In 2000, Bolivians successfully blocked privatization of the country's water. Last summer, social movements shut down the capital city, occupied oil fields, and forced the resignation of two successive presidents with their demand for nationalization of the oil and gas industries. Now these social movements are claiming as their latest victory the election of Evo Morales as Bolivia's president. Morales is the country's first indigenous president and is the leader of the movement towards socialism, or MAS party. Last weekend, during a swearing-in ceremony, Morales repeated his pledges to fight neoliberalism and return control of the country to the indigenous majority. Adriana Paz is a Bolivian activist and journalist living in Vancouver. She recently returned from Bolivia and has joined us in the studio. Good morning, Adriana.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you for coming down. You were in Bolivia at the time of the December election. Mm-hmm. What was the mood there since Morales has been elected president?
Well, the mood before Evo has elected. Well, I think the general mood, it's a lot of happiness and hope. And almost everybody, I mean, almost, I said almost because the businessman people, they are kind of afraid. They are just saying all the worst thing that can happen in Bolivia. But the general mood is a lot of hope and happiness. I think that the decision of the people of Bolivia to change the course of history by electing a total and another type of government, it has been very, very clear. So the mood is happiness and celebration. And of course, there are certain uncertainties because it's totally new for the people to be on the power of the government. And there are a lot of hope and happiness.
After his inauguration last weekend, Morales announced the appointment of his cabinet ministers. Is this government structured differently than others have been?
Yes. The new restructuring of the government has begun with main changes, like the creation of new and key ministries, like the Ministry of the Water and Mining, and the elimination of the Ministry of the Indigenous People. But those key ministries, like the Water and Mining, it's very strategic, not only in terms that they are going to pay attention, special attention to the recovery of the natural resources like the water and like the gas, but because the social movements that have been led to the resignation of the two presidents have come from that sector. The people who has mobilized for the water war and for the miners having also have played a great and key role on the recovery of all these natural resources. So it's not only to pay attention to the natural resources, but also to strengthen and to give to reinforce the organization of these sectors that are very, very the life and the energy of the social movements in Bolivia. So that's a very important change. And also talking about who is in the head of these ministries, this is also something very new that this government is changing, because usually the ministries are being given to the fat cats of the people from the coalition, from the ruling coalition. Now the ministries are in hands of the people, from leaders, labor leaders, indigenous people, and peasants, poor farm workers. So, and a small amount of leftist academics and urban people, we can say. But it's, for example, we have 16 ministers are indigenous, and they really come from the base. So that's a huge change, and that can put more pressure on making change fast, because it's people that never have been before in these power positions. But I think it's a democratic revolution.
Are there any of the new cabinet ministers that you could talk specifically about?
Yes, For example, the water ministry, the minister of the water ministry, it's the leader, the labor leader of El Alto, who has led the struggle to recover the water for the municipality. So that's an example. The other example is, for example, the minister of the economy. I know that person. She's a woman. She's a peasant woman who came from the basis. So it's amazing that people like her, it's on the head of that ministries. And also the minister of mining, it's the leader of the miners. So that's a very concrete examples of the change that the Evo Morales government is doing.
What challenges do you think that these more popular or labor-based leaders will have now that they're running the country?
I think one of the main challenges is going to be are going to come from internally. I mean, the social movements are going now to press to the government and to their own ministers to meet their demands in short-term period. And that's going to be a challenge to transform that feeling in a feeling of inclusion on the exercising of the power. So because there are a lot of expectations, and we cannot forget that Bolivia is still the poorest country in South America, so they want to see changes very soon. So transforming that feeling into an inclusion of the exercise of power. And well, the challenge of the external challenge, I think, are the most worries challenge that this government is going to face, because the challenge is to join to the left regional bloc that Venezuela and Cuba and Argentina are forming. But meanwhile, Evo is going to still to have to negotiate delicate issues like the with USA, like the drug wars, like the NAFTA or ALCA, the trade agreements. So the challenge is how to join to the left bloc, but without still having to deal with the U.S., but from a point of view that with sovereignty and not from submission attitude. So that is quite a challenge to balance that.
Is there a lot of pressure from people's expectations of what this new government will deliver?
Yes, there are a lot of expectations. As I said before, there are a lot of happiness, but a lot of hope in the meantime. So the leader, the labor leaders and the bases have been saying last week ago that they are going to have patient, that they know that this is going to be a struggle for everybody. One struggle was to go to the power, and now it's to really keep in the power and trying to meet their demands. So they are like in a good terms, and everybody's willing to wait. So they are very conscious that their leaders need time and need support.
Nationalization of oil and gas resources has been a central demand of Bolivia's social movements and is something Morales committed to during the election. How is the new government approaching this issue?
Well, yes, nationalization has been in the center of the main struggles and demands and blockades for the last 2 years. So now it's a requirement, it's a demand that the mass have to address this issue as soon as possible. But there is a nationalization can mean different things for different people. There are the radical people in Bolivia, the indigenous radical party like the MIP of Felipe Quispe, that for them nationalization it means to have 100% of the ownership of the natural resources and the infrastructure of the oil corporations. But for different people means different things. And for the mass approach, nationalization means that they are going to still having oil corporations in Bolivia, but they are going to be partners, no owners of the natural resources like is right now. So they are going to deal with them in these terms. The state and the government is the owner of the natural resources, and the government is going to decide to whom, when, and to where they are going to transport and they are going to sell the gas. So it's a very different perspective and approach, but they cannot change the rules In a short-term period, because first they have to hold the constituent assembly. That's the scenario to change the rules in order to be able to negotiate with a better conditions with the oil corporations. So the approach is that we still need the money from the oil corporations, but we are but they are not only more the owners of the gas. So that's the mass approach, and I think it's a, they call it a very realistic approach and pragmatical approach, considering that Bolivia still needs the foreign aid, so we are going to use it, but from a different attitude.
Will this be enough for the more radical groups who want more complete nationalization?
Some of them, they don't agree, but these voices of radical voices, they exist, they are. And it's good that they are there, but they don't have too much popular support. Right now the people, they are conscious that they are going to need time, the changes are going to come, but not very soon. And Morales had said that we are not going to see main changes on economy, because they don't want to promise anything that they are not going to be able to achieve this year, but they have promised that they are going to set up all the necessary scenario for the Constituent Assembly. So that's now the Constituent Assembly is in August. So that's the greatest scenario to really end with the colonial state, as Evo Morales said, and to set new rules to deal with the oil corporations and multilateral financial institutions.
What are your hopes for the process to rewrite the constitution?
Well, I am very, very optimistic. I think this is the time for Bolivia to really recreate the, refound, as they said, refound the government, the new state. I think this is the great opportunity to give the power to the people, the constituent power to the people, and to create new rules to end with the colonial state. I think it's going to be a very difficult process because there are different confronted positions, people from different regions of Bolivia, they have different points of view, and there are different kind of ethnias and indigenous groups, and they have a different vision of the country, but it's so good that finally all these visions are going to get together on this important scenario. And so this is an excellent democratic exercise of the democracy. So I am very optimistic with this historic opportunity that Bolivia has. And I am pretty confident that the people is going to really take advantage and they are going to be able to refound a new state, finally, after 500 years.
Morales has been talking about how Bolivia now forms part of the axis of good in Latin America, along with Venezuela, Cuba, and Argentina. What do you think Bolivia will contribute to this network of left-leaning governments?
Well, I think as soon as Evo has been elected, the first thing that he did was to go to Cuba, right? Like saying, it's clear that we're going to join to the left bloc in South America, in Latin America. And then he went to Venezuela, which is also key. He went and he said, it's clear that we are going to make agreements and we are going to join to this left bloc. And in the last week have been made important agreements with Venezuela and with Cuba. So Bolivia is willing to be part of the large energy bloc that Venezuela with Argentina and Brazil are creating. And Bolivia is in a very key position in terms of geography. So Bolivia is willing to be the link between north and south and west and east. And it in infrastructure, but also in policies of redistribution, transportation, and to be partners of what countries. So this geographical key position is going to be one of the main contributions of Bolivia, but also, of course, the willing to be part of a left blocked. And Evo, it's funny because he always, well, I have to say that many people are like, well, USA, concretely, they say that, Evo Morales, it's part of this bloc, they call the El Eje del Mal, it's like the evil edge. So, and it's funny because it's just an attempt to be to be joined to the left bloc for Latin America.
Well, thank you very much for coming to speak with me this morning.
Well, thank you too much for giving me the opportunity to share a bit what is happening in Bolivia right now.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Bolivian activist and journalist Adriana Paz. Adriana will be one of the speakers at Bolivia, A People's Victory, an event sponsored by the Canada-Bolivia Solidarity Committee.
That was an interview by Red Eye Cooperative Radio. You're listening to Making Ways, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. Now, for our People's History section, some people's history, our history, to look back on, remember, and be inspired by. We again hear this week from Michael Parenti, this time on The Phony War on Crime.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, is now available. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
The Phony War on Crime. More than a half century ago, Dwight Eisenhower campaigned his way into the White House on a platform that promised to fight communism, crime, and corruption. In all the years that followed, political office holders have heaped praise upon themselves for tirelessly waging a war on crime and a war on drugs, outdoing each other in trying to appear tough on this issue. Police and prison budgets skyrocketed, as did prison populations, the latter consisting heavily of nonviolent drug offenders serving draconian sentences. Under such bombardments, public fear about crime accelerated far more precipitously than the actual crime rate. Today, America is a nation feeling itself under siege from its criminal element. It's a land of gated communities, heavily guarded apartment towers, and millions of households armed with guns ready to dispatch unidentified trespassers. Fear of crime is supplemented with fear of ethnic minorities, terrorists, immigrants, foreigners, gays, feminists, rampaging teenagers, and outspoken peace protesters in what amounts to a generalized culture of fear. Menacing images are implanted in our brains during our most imaginative and malleable years. In the United States, millions of children spend thousands of hours in front of the TV every year, ingesting a steady diet of violence-ridden programs. By the time the average teenager is graduated from high school, he or she will have witnessed about 13,000 TV killings, and many times that number of assaults, fistfights, robberies, shootouts, rapes, and attempted rapes. A survey by the National Institute of Mental Health found that the level of fear among children increases with heavy TV viewing. Very young children, unable to grasp the motives behind the violence, tend to see almost everyone on television as involved in a universal mode of brutality and threat. And not just children. Adults, too, ingest a steady diet of shows that feature every known violent act. Deranged murderers terrorize train passengers. Kidnappers torment and kill their captives. Terrorized women careen around in their homes, stalked by determined intruders. Vampires slurp the blood of trembling maidens. Ghoulish maniacs massacre people with chainsaws, and on and on. After enough days, months, and years of consuming this kind of fare, we might well be ready to vote for authoritarian law and order candidates, support the death penalty, increase military spending, bomb Iraq, buy a gun, and shoot anybody who strolls across our lawn after dusk. In the thriller films pitched to both young and older audiences, The basic paradigm is roughly the same. The world is swarming with fearsome aggressors who want to do us in. Virtuous Americans are menaced by evil foreigners, communists, cutthroats, diabolic geniuses, screaming savages, alien space invaders, giant asteroids, slimy serpentine creatures from beneath the lagoon, murderous mutant microbes, and other natural and supernatural perils. In these films, the ordinary people seem unable to defend themselves through collective action. Their role is to run hither and thither, screaming to be saved from the menace. And saved they are, after suffering enough casualties, by individual heroes or state authorities who use generous applications of firepower to make everything nice again. Good guys and their enemies never get together to negotiate a peaceful settlement. They only meet to go at each other's throats. Fed a lifelong diet of such offerings, many Americans have little difficulty accepting the picture painted by our leaders of a world full of vicious adversaries, lurking within and without our borders, just waiting to pounce upon us. These malefactors can only be deterred by more police, more prisons, more repressive laws, more military spending, more and huge military establishment, and more wars. This is the great crime hype. And this is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse.
You're listening to Making Waves. Now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. In keeping with our theme of electoral reform and activism, we'll hear today on the show from Bev Harris of Black Box Voting about the flawed election machinery jeopardizing clean 2006 congressional elections.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bev Harris, founder of the group Black Box Voting, who examines the flaws and vulnerabilities found in electronic voting systems being used across the U.S. William Greider, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses the grassroots movement gathering to challenge conservative Democrat U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut. And Ardith Platte, a Dominican nun and peace activist recently released from federal prison for anti-war civil disobedience, who talks about the conditions for women she encountered in jail. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For 26 years, the U.S. Senate has refused to ratify the Global Bill of Rights for Women, officially called the United Nations Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW. The treaty has been approved by 170 nations, and the U.S. is the only industrialized nation to oppose it. Women's rights advocates see a great deal of hypocrisy in the American position. As Ruth Sharma of the Women's Edge Coalition told the website OneWorld.net, the U.S. wants to protect women's rights across the world, including the Middle East, but that rings a little hollow if it does not sign the Women's Rights Treaty. However, U.S. opposition to the Women's Bill of Rights is not unique. Washington is hostile to a growing number of international conventions on weapons, global warming, and the rights of children. The Bush administration is opposed to a long list of UN conventions, such as the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty on Nuclear Weapons, the Anti-Landmine Treaty, a new compliance agreement for the Biological Weapons Treaty, and the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, held up the adoption of the two-year UN operating budget, insisting the UN make management and administrative changes. 20 years ago, people power in the Philippines drove brutal dictator Ferdinand Marcos out of power. In 2001, tens of thousands of Filipinos returned to the streets and pushed President Joseph Estrada out of office for accepting millions of pesos from illegal gambling activity. Yet the streets of Manila were relatively calm in 2005 when Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo was charged with manipulating the May 2004 election. She later apologized for a lapse in judgment and successfully stopped efforts to impeach her. According to The Nation magazine, anti-Arroyo activists could only mobilize 40,000 people in mass protests, far fewer than the hundreds of thousands that jammed Manila streets to oppose Marcos in 1986 and Estrada in 2001. Observers blame apathy in the belief that the entire political system is corrupt. Increasingly, people are leaving the Philippines for better opportunities in Europe, the United States, and the Middle East. It is estimated that 30% of Filipino household income comes from 8 million citizens working overseas. There is also growing frustration with a stagnant economy that is guided by Washington-backed neoliberal policies. The Philippines' once powerful non-governmental organizations and human rights groups lost their voice when many protest leaders joined the government bureaucracy. But a new generation of activists emerged in the Arroyo crisis, calling for participatory democracy and a new transitional government. The people of rural Alston in northeast England face a pressing local crisis, shrinking population. The town currently has 2,000 residents, just 10% of its former size. To combat the flight of its residents into bigger urban areas, the town has created its own matchmaking agency, recruiting people to move in looking for mates. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, countries across Europe and Japan have seen fertility rates fall below the recognized replacement rate of 2.1 children per couple. The population has fallen in 7 of the 25 European Union countries. Still, with rising migration into big cities like London, the overall European population is expected to rise to 470 million people by 2025. It is then expected to decline by 50 million people. Increasingly, birth rates are also falling in the developing world, some dramatically. According to United Nations data, 20 developing nations have birth rates of 2 children per couple. While population stabilization seems to be occurring, activist groups like Greenpeace and Oxfam have dropped the issue from their agenda in favor of campaigns focusing on global warming and fair trade. A quiet debate is now going on about the environmental benefits of decreasing population versus fears that fewer people contributing to the workforce, tax base, and social programs could make current societal structures unsustainable. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Federal and state programs initiated after the disputed 2000 presidential election to repair the nation's flawed voting equipment resulted in cities and counties across the nation purchasing several different types of electronic voting machines. However, investigations by citizen groups have revealed serious problems with some of these machines. One of the major manufacturers of electronic ballot machines, the Ohio-based Diebold Election Systems Company, has been the target of recent investigations into their voting system security. Soon after a December test in which a Finnish computer security specialist demonstrated that vote totals on Diebold machines could be altered without detection, Volusia and Leon counties in Florida have dropped their use of Diebold equipment. Upon hearing about the Florida tests, California's Secretary of State Bruce McPherson announced that his office is putting the certification of Diebold voting devices on hold indefinitely, while it awaits further testing to validate the system's security. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bev Harris, founder of the group Black Box Voting, who examines the serious flaws found in Diebold's machines and the very real possibility that thousands of communities around the U.S. may not have certified voting machines in place for this November's midterm congressional election.
California has decided not only to hold off on certifying the Diebold machines, but in a really elegant move, they are sending the machines back to the federal testing labs, saying we want certain things examined. And what's so interesting is the things they ask to be examined are two specific programs that the testing labs now claim they never saw or never looked at. But these two programs we now know are in the machines. They are a violation of FEC standards. In other words, they're illegal programs. And the Secretary of State of California said to the testing labs, here are these two programs. I would like you to give me a formal report on what they are. And I think that sets up quite a trap for both Diebold and the federal testing labs. Pennsylvania has now decertified some of the Diebold machines. North Carolina, Diebold has had to pull out of because they've passed some very restrictive laws. Volusia County, our favorite, has also now dumped the Diebold machines and may actually sue the state of Florida for authorizing those machines in the first place. St. Louis County, Missouri, has dumped the Diebold machines. And what we're doing now at Black Box Voting is to do one more step of testing. This time we need to find an election supervisor somewhere in the country who can let us confirm that this illegal program is in their touch screens. We've been able to confirm it in the optical scans. We've seen it in a touch screen system. We know it's there, but we need to formally confirm it on the record with our public experts. And I think that, if and when we get that, will be the final death blow for those Diebold touch screens.
But I take it from your research and statements I've heard you make before that eliminating Diebold machines, or if a state puts in place a paper trail that is now actually the law in many states around the country, that in and of itself does not solve the problem.
Correct. You know, you have to fight it battle by battle. But the other biggest voting machine company is one called Election Systems and Software, ESNS. I just got an email this morning from a scientist that is working with another group besides blackboxvoting.org. And he has found the illegal programs in the ESNS machines, at least in the old ones. So I think what's going to happen as we start to finally pry the lid off of Pandora's box is we're going to find that most of the major manufacturers have been using illegal code. And then we've got a tough decision because we've got an election coming up. If we have no voting machines that are actually legally certified, then what do we do? And I don't really have an answer for that, and I'm sorry that I don't, but it's not the citizens' fault that we ended up with this boondoggle in the first place.
So you're looking ahead to the November 2006 congressional election, very important congressional election where actually a lot's at stake.
Right.
And you got two problems, I guess. Number one is there's a lack of confidence generally among a certain important segment of the population that really doesn't trust the electoral system. And then, of course, if problems, the Diebold machines and ESNS machines come to the surface in a bigger way in the intervening months, now in the November elections, you got more of a credibility problem. And then you're saying if they can't be certified, there's no machines to have elections on.
Right. It really is a problem. And let's look at something even more fundamental. I mean, it was a little bit hasty and wrong-headed to run off and say we're going to make ourselves dependent on voting machines in the first place. Look at what happened in Louisiana. New Orleans had to cancel elections. Now, here are some people who really wanted to vote because they had some issues they want to deal with. They had to cancel the elections because the machines were flooded. You know, I'm sorry, but we still have copy shops. We can still make ballots. There's still pencils that you can get. And it's very strange to me that we have decided that we can't possibly run an election simply by filling out paper ballots and counting them. I know that it's complicated, but I think we've really opened a problem up here by making ourselves completely dependent on these machines because all kinds of things, you know, what the least of which is we shouldn't trust them because the machines are not secure. Now, we always hear, oh, you know, Canada does paper ballots, but that's different because they only put one or two races on the ballot. We love to load our ballots up with all kinds of things, and that changes the equation. But there is a township in New Hampshire that has 3,500 voters, so that's larger than the largest precinct. They have up to 30 questions on the ballot, and they hand count, and they have their election results in by election night, often ahead of the voting machines. I think what we need to do is start seeking out the expertise of these places and find out how they have it organized and how they do it. You know, go and look at a role model who actually gets how to do it using the same kinds of challenges we have elsewhere, and so that we can get a backup plan in place.
That was Bev Harris, founder of the group Black Box Voting and author of the book Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. Visit her group's website at www.blackboxvoting.org. Just after delivering his State of the Union address in January 2005, President Bush embraced and kissed the cheek of U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut. The conservative Democrat, who was presidential candidate Al Gore's running mate in the 2000 election, has infuriated many in his party over the last few years by supporting Mr. Bush on several key issues. Progressive Democrats in Connecticut and around the nation were angered by Lieberman's kind words for President Bush's proposal to partially privatize Social Security, which ultimately failed. Lieberman's steadfast and vocal support for the president's war in Iraq has also created animosity toward the three-term senator, who supported several of Mr. Bush's controversial cabinet appointments. Over the past year, a grassroots movement of angry Democrats has begun to search for a candidate to challenge Mr. Lieberman when he runs for re-election in November 2006. Former Senator and Connecticut Governor Lowell Weicker has expressed interest in the plan. Lieberman ousted Weicker from his Senate seat in 1988. The well-organized liberal group MoveOn.org has also stated its interest in raising money for a Lieberman challenge. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with William Greider, the Nation magazine's national affairs correspondent, who explains why he believes an effective campaign against Lieberman could have national repercussions in reinvigorating the Democratic Party.
Well, he's described in the big media typically as a centrist, and I suppose you can say almost everybody is at some point in their lives. Right now, I think he's center right. He's very close to the Democratic Leadership Council. He's very close to business interests, and not just Connecticut business interests, although they're important to him. And he is very much in line with the Republican neocons on the war. The war is galvanizing people's feelings about Joe Lieberman, surely more than on any of those other subjects. But there's been a lot of resentment out there for quite a while among people who think of themselves as rank and file loyal Democrats, liberal in their persuasion on most issues, worried about things that in his youth Lieberman himself was associated with. As you know, MoveOn.org, which has a pretty substantial base in Connecticut, was saying if the voters in Connecticut who are part of our network of activist voters decide to do this and they really have a plausible candidate and go forward, we'll support them, we'll help them. And that's a pretty serious thing now in politics, because Move On can raise a lot of money. And I think what's interesting and potentially important about this is that what the Democratic Party has been missing for some years, I mean several decades really, is the ability of the grassroots to get back on its feet and say, we're going to start holding people accountable for wavering on principles, basically turning their backs on the loyal constituencies in favor of seeking that magic middle. If voters in Connecticut do that and have some real impact, that could be the start of something big.
There's a lot of frustration among many progressive Democrats of the weak, kneed, kind of spineless positions the Democratic Party in general has taken during the last 5 years of this Bush administration. So you're thinking that any kind of profound and, as you say, successful opposition to Joe Lieberman could sober up a lot of wavering Democrats.
I actually wrote this in the book I wrote now nearly 15 years ago, Who Will Tell the People, where I was describing the decay of the both political parties. But Republicans understand this a lot better than present-day Democrats, that part of the whole representative system we call democracy is based on the idea that citizens at large, constituents, voters, will now and then hold their incumbents accountable when those incumbents essentially break their trust with their base of that they're supposedly representing. I have watched the Congress now in Washington for longer than I wish to say, but decades. And what I have observed is that nothing gets the attention of incumbent politicians in this town quicker, more powerfully than seeing some of their colleagues taken down by an issue and by constituents who felt ignored and who indeed were ignored. And that was a principal element in how the right wing built its ascendancy within the Republican Party and ultimately how it changed the Republican Party. So I'm suggesting to people who are frustrated and angry, if you are not willing to do this, to assert accountability as citizens, you will continue to be ignored. And that's a logic every politician, I don't care left, right, center, understands.
Let me ask you a quick last question, if I could, William Grider, and that is on Lowell Weicker. Although, you know, we don't have a crystal ball, we don't know if he's going to run against Joe Lieberman this November. What kind of candidate do you think he would make, a former maverick, quote-unquote, Republican senator who challenged Richard Nixon during the Watergate era and an independent governor of Connecticut? Do you think he could successfully challenge Joe Lieberman?
My sense of Lowell Weicker is that he is distinctively himself, and that's a big asset. And he's never been, from the 1970 on, anybody's boy, right? And he just isn't. Which I admire, and he's also, I think, in terms of issues, he's a Republican and not hostile to business. I think of him in the lineage of Rockefeller Republicans, which is a type nearly extinguished, as you know, in the Republican Party. And he's still there, being himself and in a very provocative, independent way. I'm told by people who live there that he's got a tremendous respect and good feeling from among Connecticut voters. So my guess is what they say is correct, which is that he would give Lieberman a very serious run. The only downside I see in that, and this I hear from Democrats, is that you could wind up in a weird situation where Republicans, conservatives, right-wingers cross over and vote for Lieberman, and you end up splitting the vote two or three ways so that Lieberman comes through, basically, because the opposition to him is now splintered. But, you know, that doesn't bother me either. There are a bunch of people across the country talking about doing challenge races within the Democratic Party. I can't tell you how many of them are really serious or can really find a plausible candidate that might take a real bite out of the incumbent. But my view is, at this point, I'm for long shots and I'm for good bets. I mean, I'm for whatever stimulates people to get out of their chairs and become active and take their convictions seriously. It really comes down to that. If you want your convictions to prevail, you've got to do more than simply yell at the TV set every night. And I see that happening, so I'm feeling hopeful.
That was William Grider, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read his piece about Senator Lieberman titled The Rise of the Rebels in the December 24th edition of The Nation, or visit the magazine's website at www.thenation.com. Sister Ardith Platé is one of three Dominican sisters who took part in a plowshares action in October 2002 in Greeley, Colorado. The nuns entered a Minuteman missile site, hammered on the silo, and made the sign of the cross on it with their own blood. In April 2003, they were found guilty of interference, injury, or obstruction of national defense materials and degradation of government property. Platé, who was 70 years old and a peace activist for many decades, received the longest sentence, 41 months. She was released on December 22, 2005, but still faces 3 years of probation and must pay restitution for damage at the missile silo. Platé and her co-defendants say they are unwilling to pay the government restitution because some of the funds would be dedicated to war. The nun served part of her sentence in Danbury Federal Prison in Connecticut, and shortly after her release, spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about conditions for women she encountered in prison and how women there forged a community among themselves.
I always feel that we are the ones that care about each other. And so, of course, I love people with whom I'm living and walking and working. I listened to so many stories, shed many tears, rejoiced in celebrations with people. I mean, we are for each other, all that we have. You know, we're under the domination of a hierarchy of people. and we're always under their monitoring. So all of the work is done by prisoners. All the food is prepared, all of the electrical, plumbing, ground care, all of the federal housing of the staff people, all of the construction needs, all of the lawn care, that's taken care of by the prisoners. There usually is one supervisor for each of those areas. We do all of the cleaning within the building. I happen to be privileged, I feel, to do chapel as a chapel clerk. That gave me the responsibility to serve all of the different faiths and practices and rituals in the prison of all the people. I also had an opportunity to worship with people in different faiths and to learn about their beliefs. It was just a great privilege for me. I felt honored to, you know, to learn more about Muslims and Buddhists and Native American spirituality, Jewish, Jehovah Witness, Wiccan, all the different faith traditions. So to me, that gave me an opportunity, too, to listen to people's stories, especially when they lost their parents or when their grandmothers died or when someone was sick in the family. You know, I feel that the greatest service that is rendered is through the spiritual needs. And there again, a lot of that depends in different prisons upon chaplains. But I just felt honored to work for the chaplains in the Danbury prison.
There have been exposés lately of the terrible medical care that prisoners receive. I know you yourself had a serious medical problem while you were in Danbury that was not treated properly.
The medical treatment is not sufficient. I don't think anyone given a sentence of any number of years was given a life sentence in the sense that they are designated to die within a prison. And in fact, the budgets that are cut first again are those that would be beneficial for prisoners. While I was at Danbury Federal Prison, in just the one unit that I was in, I know of four people who died. I also know of persons who committed suicide on the compound of Danbury. I can't imagine what families suffer when they send their daughters to prison in self-surrender or in designated sentences, and then they never come out alive. I think that would be one of the greatest sufferings, because even when they come in ill, they deserve treatment. Now, many of the women who come in have, for example, lupus or sickle cell anemia, or have been injured, yes, by drug abuse. But aren't we responsible then for trying to treat the drug addiction and to heal the person so that they will be good citizens within the community once they are released? I feel also that those that have committed suicide within the prison system, that prison is responsible for the people there. They're under their guard, their vigilance on an ongoing basis. And if they're that desperate that they commit suicide, it seems to me there should have been enough vigilance to care for them that would never happen. Because there are persons who need deep psychological treatment. There are many persons who have health needs. That seems urgent. The educational needs are urgent. The skill building needs are urgent. I would think that if we really cared about what we are paying for in prisons today, that we would be doing much more in a positive way so that when women go back to their families, that they can live well within the community and help their families within the community. Recidivism is very expensive, and the prisons are extremely expensive. So in order, again, to eliminate a prison industrial complex as it exists today would be one of my motivations, and I will speak about it as I return out into the community and address issues.
That was Dominican Sister Ardeth Plate. Contact Sister Plate's peace community, Jonah House, by calling area code 410-233-6238 or visit their website at www.jonahhouse.org. For more information on the Plowshares disarmament actions, visit www.plowsharesactions.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group, Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA needs your membership, support, and participation, particularly with their new push for a backup transmitter. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Or call the station at 430-WSCA. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Arundhati Roy. It's odd how those who dismiss the peace movement as utopian don't hesitate to proffer the most absurdly dreamy reasons for going to war. To stamp out terrorism, install democracy, eliminate fascism, and most entertainingly, to rid the world of evildoers.